Against seemingly impossible odds, one woman rose from obscurity to defend her people and to save her countrymen. No, this is not an ad for Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. This is actually a true story from the pages of Scripture about Queen Esther. Now, many of us have probably heard of Queen Esther. We may be familiar with her story. I doubt that many of us have given serious consideration as to how the book that bears her name has any relevance to our lives in the 21st century. So let me put the story of Esther in modern terms. The President of the United States, an egomaniac that loves to brag about how smart and how rich he is, holds a state dinner at the White House. Throughout the affair, he's boasting about his military power that's at his disposal, the superior technology of his nation, and his own personal wealth. At the height of the evening, he calls for his wife to be brought in so that he can display her beauty to the visiting heads of state. Now, the First Lady, who herself is hosting the wives of these dignitaries in another part of the executive mansion, is summoned by the Secret Service to come and parade herself in front of her husband and his guests. Now, assuming that he and probably a good number of the others have had too much to drink, she just refuses to go and to be ogled by a bunch of inebriated men. And, of course, the president is humiliated. After conferring with his cabinet, the president announces that he is divorcing his wife, who must vacate the White House immediately. But since America has to have a first lady, he devises a plan. Let's bring in beautiful single women from all around the country and have a sort of a contest. We'll call it a beauty pageant. Maybe we'll call it Miss America. Whoever's chosen will be given a title, and I'll marry her and she'll become the first lady. So in time, 51 women are brought before the president, one from each state and the District of Columbia. And to everyone's surprise, he chooses an immigrant orphan from there in the poverty of the capital city itself. With much fanfare, the two are married. She is installed as the first lady of the United States. Now, later on, the president's chief of staff, himself an arrogant, obnoxious bigot, convinces the president to sign an executive order that orders all people of Arab descent out of the country in 90 days. And if they are still found in the country after 90 days, they'll be arrested and forcibly deported, and all of their property will be confiscated. What the president, the chief of staff, nor anybody else in the nation knows is that the first lady is of Arabic descent. Now, does that sound a little bit more relevant? And no, I wasn't thinking of Donald Trump when I told that story either. Just to be fair on both sides. Okay, that might be a little far-fetched. But stories of bigotry and hatred and threats of extermination have stained the pages of human history right up to the present day. The names and the places and the details change, but the essential elements of Esther's story ring true for many, even in our world of the 21st century. And it's my personal belief that the situation for the people of God in this society may well reflect the story of Esther in the not-too-distant horizon. Now, while you're turning to the book of Esther, it might take you a while. It's in between Nehemiah and Job, if that helps any. Let's consider the book as a whole before we dive into the first chapter. John Kitchen, in his excellent little book, Long Story Short, writes, "Esther is a strange and a wonderful book." Now, that's a combination you don't hear very often. Strange and wonderful. It is strange because throughout the whole book, not one time is God named. He's not even really referred to. In 167 verses, you'll hear of the king of Persia 190 times. You hear the name Xerxes another 29 times outside of that. And that's made it really hard for both Jewish and Christian scholars to say, what is Esther doing in our Bible? It never mentions God. You'll never see prayer mentioned. Oh, yes, it's true. There's some fasting going on, but it's never mentioned in the context of prayer. That makes sense. You wouldn't mention prayer if you don't mention God. The book of Esther is never quoted in the New Testament. It's not even referred to in those 27 books. But we do see the superstition of the heathen. We're introduced to a pagan court and a great world monarch who was pretty much a godless man. So this is indeed an unusual book. Now, among the Jewish people, it's very popular. In some circles, it ranked just below the Torah, the law of Moses. And to this day, in Jewish communities and households, they retell the story, and it's done with a lot of dramatic flair. And when the good people are introduced, everybody that's listening will cheer. And when the bad guys are introduced, they boo. I mean, they really get into the telling of the story of Esther. But among scholars, the book is very controversial. And the reactions tend to not be neutral. They either love it or they hate it. They either embrace it or they totally dismiss it. You know, one scholar writes, the plot is structured on improbabilities, exaggerations, misunderstandings, and reversals. Esther keeps her identity hidden, although her relation to Mordecai the Jew is very well known. An insignificant Jewish minority kills 75,000 of its enemies. Haman erects a 7-story stake to impale his enemy. She writes, the characters are caricatures. Xerxes is a buffoon, never quite sure what to do, completely at the mercies of his servants, giving away his power without a thought. Haman is an erratic egomaniac with wild mood swings, concerned only for his own honor and his enemy's disgrace. Even the heroes, Mordecai and Esther, seem one-dimensional and unrealistic. In fact, nothing about the events of the story is realistic, and therefore attempts to read history from it are misguided. The setting of the Persian court is authentic, but the events are fictional. Now, that's a Jewish scholar writing about the book of Esther. She concludes, Esther is best read as a comedy. Now, I'll admit, there's some real irony that goes on in this book. There are some things in here that's going to make you smile. But I don't think this was written as a comedy. I don't even think you can pass it off, as other scholars do, as historical fiction. Another Jewish scholar, a very renowned scholar named Robert Gordas, writes, clearly the book of Esther is not a historical work in the modern sense of the term, but it does reflect a real historic incident. We believe the book is to be regarded as basically a historical account of an anti-Semitic attempt at genocide, which was foiled during the reign of the very real King Xerxes. Now, among Christians, Esther wasn't even accepted as a biblical book for a long time. The first commentary written on it was 831 years after Christ. Martin Luther said about it, I'm so hostile to the book and to Esther, I wish they just didn't exist. They Judaize too much and they revel and reveal much pagan bad behavior. So yeah, Esther is a strange book. But it's a wonderful book too. Because though God's name is not ever found in its pages, his hand is everywhere in the story. You never hear him called by name, but you see him in almost every verse, certainly in every event. The setting of the story is dark, indeed, even bordering on hopeless at times. And on such occasions, we're tempted to ask, where is God? Why isn't he doing anything? We wonder, like those disciples did in the midst of the storm. They woke Jesus up and said, don't you care if we're going to die? Have you ever been in a situation like that? Have you ever felt so hopeless, so helpless, so all alone that you wonder if you're not in the same situation as Job, who cries out for God and doesn't hear any kind of response? That's what Esther is all about. Esther is set in a world where evil seems to be on the throne, and the people of God are at its mercy and are even threatened. And we wonder, where is God? What's God doing? Is he doing anything at all? Chuck Swindoll notes, God's presence is not as intriguing as his absence. His voice is not as eloquent as his silence. Who of us has not longed for a word from God, searched for a glimpse of his power, or yearned for some reassurance of his presence, only to feel like he seems absent, distant, preoccupied, maybe even unconcerned? Yet later we realize how very present he was all along. Though God may at times seem distant, and though he is invisible to us, he is always invincible. And that is the main lesson of the book of Esther. Though absent by name from the pages of this particular book in Jewish history, God is present in every scene, in every movement of every event, until he ultimately and finally brings everything to a marvelous climax as he proves himself Lord of his people. You see, the book of Esther portrays that age-old paradox of how can evil exist and at times even appear to triumph if God is as good and as great as the Bible claims to be. Trust me, those millions of Jews who went through the concentration camps in Germany during World War II, they were wondering these same things. Many of them questioned, where is God? And some of them even became atheists, because they couldn't see God at work. They couldn't understand why he was allowing this to happen. And it's a book of great importance to us in our age, this postmodern society, which calls into question everything that used to be just taken for granted. Of course we believe in a creator God. Of course we believe in prayer. Of course we believe there's a standard of right and wrong. None of those things are taken for granted anymore. And people can talk about moral majority all they want. Folks, those who are truly following Jesus Christ are the minority in this culture. We might as well accept it, embrace it, and not fool ourselves anymore. And our society is going downhill. Really, really fast. It seems like every week, if not every day, we're just digging that hole a little deeper. It's a very relevant book. And it's one that will encourage us that even when times look the darkest, God is still there. Now let's turn to the story itself. Chapter 1 sets the stage for the whole story. And I got to be honest with you. When I was putting this together, there's a lot of what I find very interesting historical elements in the story. I realize it's probably not that interesting to a lot of you, so I'm going to try to maybe skip over a little bit of that. If you're really interested in it, I'd encourage you to go online, download the printed copy of the sermon. You'll get more of the details, but I don't want to keep you till noon, so we'll see what we can do here. Verse 1 introduces us to the present king of Persia. It says this is what happened during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush, which was an ancient name for Ethiopia. Now, some of your Bibles have the name Ahasuerus. That was the Hebrew rendering of his Persian name, which I can't even begin to try to pronounce. Some translations follow the Septuagint, the Greek reading of Artaxerxes, but that's a mistake. Artaxerxes was the son of Xerxes, and it's Xerxes that is the king during Esther's time. Xerxes reigned from 486 to 465 BC. He reigned for 21 years. His father was Darius I, and under his reign, the prophets Haggai and Zechariah were ministering in the land of Judah, of Judea. Xerxes' grandfather was Cyrus the Great. We hear about him in Ezra and in Nehemiah. He was the one who allowed Jews to go back and rebuild Jerusalem. But what you find is that a lot of the Jews didn't go back. A lot of the Jews who had been taken out of their land into exile by the Babylonians about 100 years before, even though they were given the opportunity to return home, they just stayed put. And there were a lot of Jews in Persia at the time and in the Persian capital in particular. So as the story begins, Xerxes was just in the third year of his 21-year reign. And he was a very powerful king. He inherited this empire that stretched from the border of what we would now know of as India. They don't believe that the Persian Empire went into the Indian Peninsula, what we would think of as India today, more like Pakistan, but right up to the Indus River, because there was a lot of gold there, and that's why Darius conquered out there to get that gold. It stretched from there all the way past Egypt into North Africa. A huge, huge empire of that day. We learn a lot about Xerxes from the writings of a Greek historian named Herodotus. He was best known for his histories. They were written about 20 years after the end of Xerxes' reign. So very much a contemporary. But what you've got to understand about Herodotus is he was Greek. And the Persian king Xerxes tried to overtake the Greek land. And in fact, some of those battles are some of the most famous in ancient history. Xerxes was defeated every time he tried to attack Greece. So we learn a lot about Xerxes from Herodotus. But just remember, Herodotus was the enemy. All right? It would be a little bit like, oh, let's see. If you were to find a biography of George W. Bush that was written by Al Gore. Okay? That's kind of the idea here, okay? So there's probably a lot of facts. There's probably a lot you can gain from it, but just understand it's a little bit biased. And Herodotus does shed some light not only on what Xerxes did, but the kind of person that he was. And it remarkably is very, very similar to the portrait here in Esther. Now, the story of Esther spans a good part of Xerxes' reign. And even though we don't see the name Esther, we don't even find the name Queen Vashti, who we're going to look at in a minute, in the story, it does fit into what we do know of Xerxes' reign and the kind of person that he was. Now, verse 2 tells us that these events took place at the citadel of Susa. Now, again, in the King James Version, that is Shushan. It means the same thing. It was the capital of the Persian Empire. It's actually one of four capitals that the king would rotate through. This one was the winter palace. In the summer at this place, and this, just to give you an idea, it was located in modern Iran, not far from the Iraqi border. Now, during the summertime, it would get as hot as 140 degrees in this location. The local legend was that if a snake tried to go across the road, it would burn to death before it got to the other side. And so the king would pack up and he would go further north where it wasn't quite so hot during the summer. But in the wintertime, this is where he would hold court. Archaeologists have discovered Xerxes' palace and the mosaic tiled floors that Bonnie read about earlier. They have found them. And it is very much what the Bible records. There was a very rich empire that was reflected in the king's palace. The city was actually divided into two sections. There was the lower city, and that's where all the people lived. And then there was the upper city, which was a 10-acre fortified palace where the king lived. And that's where much of this takes place. The palace was built by Xerxes' father, Darius, and then used by several of his successors. What you get the impression of here in these early verses is kind of an episode of the lifestyles of the rich and famous. They spared no expense. And Xerxes, when he puts on this banquet, he wants to show it off. And so they pull out all the stops. And the cups that they're drinking wine out of are gold. Archaeologists actually found one of those cups dating from that era. Everything was just to the hilt. One scholar calls this a sort of a world's fair, kind of the expos that they used to put on every so often. He called this Expo 482 BC. All of the latest of the technology. I'm sure he had the army march by so that all of these rulers from around the known world would be impressed with his power and with his wealth. Now, the timing of it all suggests that Xerxes called in all of these provincial leaders to win them over for this Greek invasion, because he was about to launch this invasion into Greece, which he was unsuccessful at two different times. But it seems that that's why he was bringing all of them in. They were getting together. He wanted to get them all on board and be supportive of this military advance that he wanted to make. Now, while this was happening on one side of the palace, verse 9 says that Queen Vashti was giving a banquet for the women in another part of the royal palace. And so you see that two parties are going on. And we read in verses 10 and 11, kind of the climax of the chapter. On the seventh day, and this is actually after the 180-day shindig he put on a smaller one for just the officials locally, probably in appreciation of the work they did on the first one. On the seventh day, when Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, you can read into that as you like, he commanded the seven eunuchs who served him to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown, in order to display her beauty to the people and the nobles, for she was lovely to look at. We are told in the histories that drinking was not only a leisure time activity for the Persians. Herodotus explained that the Persians drank as they deliberated matters of state, believing that intoxication put them closer in touch with the spiritual world. You thought that was just the hippies in the 60s that used that line. They got that from the ancient Persians. Inevitably, in all of the excess, all of this debauchery, to use the old word, the king got drunk. He just got smashed. I mean, that's the implication here. And while he's in this inebriated state, he decides he's going to show off another one of his prizes. I mean, he's already showed off the wealth, the power, now the beauty of Persia. And that was the queen. So he ordered her to be brought into the banquet hall wearing her royal crown. Now, again, scholars are a little bit mixed as to what exactly the king was asking the queen to do. See, the ancient Jewish understanding of this passage was that Queen Vashti was to come in wearing the royal crown and nothing else, if you get my drift. And some say, well, no, that probably wasn't the case. Look, the guy was drunk. I wouldn't put it past him. And it had to have been something really unusual for the queen to tell the king no, which is exactly what she did. I'm not doing this. She just said no. And that's the conscientious defiance that we see in verse 12. When the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Now, who is Queen Vashti? Her name never appears in Herodotus, nor in any of the Persian records. In Herodotus' account, Xerxes' wife is referred to by the Greek name Amestris. And we know a lot about Amestris. She was very strong-willed. She could even be cruel at times. And she was thought to be extraordinarily beautiful. Now, we do know that the name Vashti comes from the Persian meaning beautiful woman. So perhaps Vashti wasn't so much her given name as it was a title or a description of her. And sometimes in the ancient world, such titles would take on the form of a name. The histories tell us that she was the mother of Artaxerxes, who would succeed his father, who was born about 483 BC, which is precisely the time that this took place. In fact, Warren Wiersbe wonders if perhaps Vashti was pregnant with Artaxerxes, and that's one reason why she wouldn't come, that she didn't want to be displayed like that. Now, we don't know a whole lot about her. I do, by the way, believe that Queen Vashti and this Amestris from the Greek records are the same person. We do know she was a strong-minded, independent-thinking woman who was not afraid to go against the wishes of her husband, even though he was the king. Now, her defiance was dangerous on her part. If she did assume that, you know, after Xerxes sobered up, he'd forgive her, that was a serious miscalculation, as she's about to find out. It would have been probably very easy just to go along with it. Say, you know, what's it going to hurt? So a bunch of guys are going to look at me, big deal. I guess I'll just go do it, and then I'll come back and, you know, continue my feast with the ladies. But what Vashti shows here, she shows herself to be a woman of character and determination. Swindoll writes, "I admire Queen Vashti. In the midst of an unsavory scene, she was brave enough to say no to that which was blatantly wrong. And in resisting this insulting act of indignity, she took a stand against the greatest power on earth at the time." Good for her. You know, how ironic that such an example of courage and nobility would come not from a Jewish person at this point in the story, but from a pagan queen. Perhaps one reason for including this event, in addition to setting up the events that follow in the next chapter, was to demonstrate the need for daring dignity in dark times. You know, sometimes we Christians are put to shame by the courage and character of unbelievers who are more willing to stand up for what they believe in than we are. The temptation is to go with the flow, not to make waves, not to stick our necks out. Too often we'd rather be liked than to be respected. We'd rather hear the applause of men more than the approval of our Heavenly Father. But as British politician Edmund Burke is quoted as saying, "All that is required for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing." Vashti didn't do it. But as we see in the remainder of the chapter, such a conscientious defiance usually comes with a price tag. That's why I call this message the cost of courage, because courage often comes at a cost. Verse 12 ends, the king became furious and burned with anger. And as you go through the rest of the chapter, which we won't read this morning, if you go through it on your own, you'll see how he deliberated with his advisors. He called his cabinet together. You know, they blew this thing way out of proportion. Oh, if word gets out about this, all the wives will start telling their husbands no. Then what will we do? Maybe that was a little bit of the irony you find in the story. But it was decided that Vashti would be demoted. Some commentators say she was taken out and executed, but that is never said. And it doesn't appear to be the case, because if Vashti is Amestris, the the queen that the Greek name holds, she comes back into the picture during the reign of her son. What I believe happened here was that there was a royal edict saying Queen Vashti can never again appear before the king. Now, there's a little humor there, too, because isn't that exactly what she was saying? I'm not going to go before you. And so he says, fine, you'll never see me again. Who knows? Maybe she said, yes. I don't know. But she lost her position, and she lost her prestige. She lost her power at that time. Now, she comes back as the queen mother with her son, but she lost all that she had at that point. Now, as we wrap this up, there's two conclusions, I think, that stand out from this passage. First, when God seems to be absent, remember that he's always there, and he is at work. I'm reminded of the story of footprints in the sand. I'm sure you've all heard of it. You know, the fellow at the end of his life looks back over his life, and he sees two sets of footprints in some places, and then only one set in the others. And it seemed like the one set was only in the darkest times of his life. And he asks the Lord, why did you abandon me when I needed you the most? I mean, you weren't there. I had to go through that alone. The Lord said, no, it's the wrong set of footprints you're looking at. Those are mine. During those times, I was carrying you. The Lord is always there. He is always present. He is always at work. And second, the cost of courage is sometimes high, but it is always worth the price. Throughout the book of Esther, we are going to see men and women who are called upon to take a stand for what's right in a world gone wrong. For Queen Vashti, her courage cost her the privilege and the prestige of her position. For others, courage will cost them their reputations, their possessions, their careers, and at times, even their lives. In our world, too, we will have to take a stand for what God says is right. And taking a stand against the flow of society is always risky. It's always costly. But it's always worth the price. Why? Because ultimately, it will be rewarded. Now, our stories aren't all going to end like Esther. Just like for those Jews in Germany during World War II, for 6 million of them, there was no rescue. But that does not mean that God is not on his throne, that God is not in charge, that God is not at work. We just haven't gotten to the end of the story yet. Because in the end, we know every wrong will be righted. Every act of courage and faithfulness will be rewarded. And as we were reminded in Sunday school this morning, we will reap a harvest if we don't get discouraged and quit. So my challenge to you today is, if you find yourself in one of those circumstances where it just seems that God isn't anywhere to be found, and everything is going wrong, you stand up for what's right and don't quit. You hang on. You haven't reached the last page of the book yet. And when you do, be assured, God is God. He is righteous, he is just, and he is powerful, and he will make things right.